You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 21st, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. How's everyone?
You don't have a special day for us today, Evan?
There's no special day today.
Today is unremarkable.
I'll put a shout out to my 5-year-old daughter, who on May 22nd, celebrating her fifth birthday. Happy birthday, Rachel.
Happy birthday, Rachel.
Wow. She's been on the show, right?
Yeah.
Yes, she has.
She asked the question to Bug Girl.
Yeah.
She did.
Yeah,
she'll be back with them. Maybe we'll get her to ask another question for something coming up this summer.
Well, we have a busy week this week. We have a couple of interviews, actually. Our main interview is with Carl Zimmer, but we also have an interview with a scientist, Michael Schull, on his astronomical research. And we have several news items to get through. The first news item is about resurrecting the extinct Tasmanian tiger, or at least one of the genes from an extinct Tasmanian tiger. The Tasmanian tiger, or the thylacine, became extinct. The last one died out in 1933. There's actually a video you can get to on YouTube showing a video of the last Tasmanian tiger in captivity.
How sad is that?
But because this is an animal that has recently gone extinct, there are actually museums, for example, in New Zealand, where the Tasmanian tiger lived, that have specimens of actual tissue. And what scientists have done recently in Australia and also the U.S. got together, and they actually extracted DNA from a specimen, from a thylacine.
A 100-year-old specimen, though.
A 100-year-old specimen, that's right, which is very interesting. They were still able to extract usable DNA. And then they implanted one of the genes for collagen into a mouse embryo, and the mouse grew up and was able to, and the gene was functional. It was actually functioning and, you know, cranking out connective tissue, doing its job. So what they proved for the first time is that you could take a 100-year-old gene and it would still function and function normally.
That's cool.
So that's very cool. And of course, you know, once you do something like this, then that leads to a tremendous amount of speculation about, well, how far is this going to go? Does this mean we're going to be able to actually have Tasmanian tigers, you know, bring them back to life? And then what about other extinct species? How far back in time are we going to be able to go with this? Well, this is still a long way from bringing back an entire Tasmanian tiger. A single gene, you know, is one thing. A full genome, as well as, you know, not only do you need the entire genome, you need to put it into a cell, an embryo that's close enough to it. So I guess you could find a marsupial that's reasonably close to the Tasmanian tiger, and then if you could get an entire genome going, you could, you know, essentially make a clone of the specimen that you have. So that's possible. They've actually also been talking about doing that with mammoths from frozen specimens from thousands of years ago. So now if we're going from 100 years ago to thousands of years ago, where we have specimens that have been frozen for the entire time, that's also theoretically possible, although it hasn't been done yet, and we don't know what the viability of that DNA would be. This, of course, lends a little bit more credibility to that, but that's still an unknown. The advantage of something like a mammoth is that there are very close living relatives, elephants, and we can make a hybrid, which might be easier to make than a full clump.
It's a hybrid.
Like a half elephant mammoth hybrid, for example, and go that route in order to eventually getting something which is almost 100% mammoth. But of course, everyone wants to know when you talk about this is, can we?
Yes.
Is this going to lead to Jurassic Park? In fact, one article on this story, the headline was "Scientists Plan Return of the Dinosaur."
No way. Wow. You actually saw that title?
That's
Holy
the title.
Crap.
I thought, like, oh my goodness. It has absolutely nothing to do with this science story.
Gee.
And even the scientists in one story say that the method that we used is not cannot be used for anything remotely like that.
Right.
And that was my biggest beef, actually, that one article said that raising the future possibility of bringing animals such as dinosaurs back to life, well, you need a genome first.
Yeah.
Tasmanian, I mean, this tiger I could see, mammoth I could possibly see, but a dinosaur, I mean, there's no viable mechanism that anyone's come up with that and a genome could have survived millions of years.
Yeah, DNA, years. The DNA as a molecule just doesn't survive for millions of years as
not
far,
in amber,
as far as we
and,
know.
You know, not unless, you know, an alien came down and preserved it nicely for us.
Right.
Is that going to happen?
Yeah, so you can think of maybe four broad categories for this kind of technique. Doing this for existing endangered species and preserving their tissue for future use, that's totally viable. Specimens that have gone extinct in recent history that we still have specimens of. And then extinct species that may have been preserved continuously in ice, like the mammoth. And then when you go beyond that to where you only have now fossil remains, I think then all bets are off. I don't think that we're going to be able to go beyond that, at least not with any extrapolation of current technology. That would require something totally new that we're not even thinking of right now. It's probably impossible that that information just still even exists.
So we're not going to bring Homo habilis back anytime soon.
That's right. Yeah, nothing. When you start talking about millions of years, I think the answer is, for the foreseeable future, the answer is no. So that was
that's
a bummer. Just shamelessly misleading headline.
Yeah, that's bad.
The next news story is about a teen in the UK who is facing prosecution because he had the audacity to call Scientology a cult.
What?
You can't call a cult a
cult. Rebecca, you didn't hear about that?
I'm joking. Oh. That was an ironic. What?
Okay, you got me on that.
Hey,
he was at an anonymous gathering, a protest outside the headquarters of the Scientology Church in London on May 10th, and he had a sign that basically called Scientology a cult. The cop came over and just commented on Section 5 of the Public Order Act, which is one of the laws in England. And it basically talks about someone would be guilty if they use threatening or abusive or insulting words or behavior or disorderly behavior or displays any writing, sign, or other visible representation which is threatening, abusive, or insulting.
Insulting, that's the one that gets me. I mean, you have a law against being insulting to somebody else. That's just a license to suppress any speech you don't like.
Yeah.
So the cops didn't succeed at that attempt, and then he recited, I guess, a quote from one of the people high up in the government, and basically that person...
Wasn't it a judge?
It was the guy was a justice. He quoted him as saying that Scientology was corrupt, sinister, and dangerous, and he did refer to it as a cult, so that was his explanation. This guy did it, so I'm doing it. That didn't go over so hot with the cops, and they issued him a summons and took his sign. So worst-case scenario, the kid could spend 6 months in jail, spend a boatload of money going to court and the whole bit. But obviously, there's a lot of other things going on here. Like, why would the cops do that? What would motivate them? Why would the sign bother them? And in my blog, I wrote about how about 20 of the local police were busted for taking pretty much bribes or, you know, expensive gifts from the Church of Scientology.
No way.
So it's kind of a dirty little thing going on. We don't really know what the answers are. And I think there should be some kind of an investigation. But who knows? I mean, this type of activity is going on.
Yeah, so there is a law on the books. Most of the time, the police don't enforce this law, but the City of London police, the ones that are relevant here, did, and it turns out they have all these connections to the Church of Scientology. So there's apparently a conflict of interest. So it is a dirty little story, and I think we're not getting all the details, but even that aside, just the notion that there's laws against just public criticism is just absurd. I mean, you know,
and that plays right into Scientologists' fantasies. I mean, this is what they try to do nonstop in every country, and it's made very difficult for them in places like here in the U.S. and in Germany, where they actually branded a cult and have certain legal implications applied to that as well.
I think they're technically branded a fascist organization in Germany.
Wow. Oh, is that what?
Ooh. Which is illegal in Germany. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
That's serious.
The laws are about how you interpret them. You know, we interpret this particular situation one way, and the police interpret them another way. And the question is why? I think that it's pretty obvious why, but the Church of Scientology can get by and has gotten by a very long time and very far with their money.
Well, we should follow this to see how this turns out. It is a terrible situation. The next news item is about mobile phones and pregnancy. We had previously discussed the overall topic of whether or not there is any health risk to using mobile phones. And the bottom line conclusion was that while there is some evidence that there may be some biological effect, if you look at all the evidence to date, there is no clear danger from using cell phones. The official recommendations are that probably shouldn't, you know, allow young children to start using cell phones early, and you know, limit your overall cell phone use if you can. But in general, there's not really much evidence that there's a danger to cell phones. Well, there's a new
and those things will also help prevent you from becoming a douchebag. So, right. It's generally just a good idea anyway.
There's a recent study looking at the use of mobile phones in pregnant women. And this studied 13,000 children, so it's a very large epidemiological study. And they found that there was an increased risk of certain behavioral abnormalities in the children of women who used a cell phone more while they were pregnant. This is a large study with a fairly robust effect. However, this is a completely retrospective study, meaning they asked women, tell us about your kids' behavior. Do they have any problems? And also tell us about your cell phone use when, you know, in the past and when you were pregnant.
Like 15 years ago.
Self-reporting about what happened in the past. Yeah, so that's the weakness of the study. And again, the problem with all studies that are looking at past behavior is that you can't randomize or control them. And you don't know what you're really looking at. It's possible that, for example, some other factor that we're not even thinking about may make women, you know, use a cell phone more and have a higher incidence of having kids with certain you know, behavioral problems, right? I mean, maybe there's certain personalities that produce both, and the cell phone may just be an innocent bystander or a marker of that. Or maybe using the cell phone just as a parenting style, you know, maybe these women are very distracted and busy and whatever, and that parenting style may be what's affecting the children's behavior. So there's lots of ways to interpret this, and that none of these things really can be controlled for in this kind of study.
Could it be that perhaps just overall in the last several years there have been more diagnoses of behavioral problems in all children, and therefore, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing. The same
yeah,
thing you see with autism.
I think that's the one thing you can say is not probably responsible for this data, because this is the same cohort of women, right? So it's not, in other words, it's all women that over the same time period, right? So it shouldn't just be a time effect. In other words, you're not comparing women from now to women from 20 years ago, you know, or whatever.
Right.
So I don't think that that's it. And these results were a bit surprising because there isn't really a plausible mechanism by which it would happen. So nobody really has proposed, like, oh, this is biologically how cell phones in a pregnant woman could influence cognitive development of the child. So they weren't expecting to see this, or at least some of the researchers who were involved with this weren't expecting to see this. So it's interesting. It's one piece of data, but again, it's always helpful to understand how to put these studies into a broader context and know what their strengths and weaknesses are. So while this is something that requires further research, you know, this kind of looking backwards epidemiological studies always need to be corroborated by looking at it multiple different ways. You really need multiple studies that sort of look at this question from every different direction before we could, you know, triangulate and say, yeah, this is the common element. It really is the cell phone use, not all these other things. This one study just cannot do that. So interesting, but not definitive.
And speaking of looking back, you know, this is how we discussed, got onto our whole fanny pack discussion that
That's
we've been
true.
Talking about for
That's
months
true.
Now.
It gets us right back to
them on your
to the
belt. Is there a risk? Is a fanny pack? You know,
yeah.
So this all kind of plays into
I did
that
not
as well.
See that coming.
Everything comes back to the fanny pack.
How sad.
One more really quick news item before we go on to a couple of emails. Last week we talked about NASA's big announcement that they found for the first time a recent supernova remnant in our own galaxy. Well, this week there's another supernova first, just announced today, actually. Astronomers happened to see for the first time ever, a supernova begin as it was actually happening. Normally, we only see supernova after they've occurred when they become bright in the visible spectrum, but the actual explosion's already occurred by that point.
So they just happened to have instruments pointed in the right direction at the right time.
Exactly. They were using an X-ray telescope to look at a galaxy. They were actually looking at another supernova, I believe, in this galaxy, or another X-ray source, when the astronomer noticed this little brief 5-minute X-ray burst somewhere else in the galaxy. And she said, hey, that could be a supernova. So they turned a whole bunch of instruments to that star, that region of the galaxy, and they saw a supernova happen. It was an incredible stroke of luck. They just happened to be looking at that galaxy when that initial X-ray burst, which is the first thing that happens really with the supernova. And a supernova is a supermassive star, a star much bigger than our own star, that burns up its fuel so it can no longer maintain itself. Its gravity causes it to collapse in on itself, which then sends a shock wave back out to the surface. When that shock wave hits the surface, you get this intense, it heats it up and you get this intense X-ray burst. That's what they saw. And then you get the supernova remnant, the exploding out bright gas of cloud that then we could see over weeks and then and over years. So we actually had the opportunity to see it in process. It was 88 million light years away. It was far away. So we're only going to be able to see it for a little while. I think like a couple of years only before it will fade and become too dim for us to see it that distance. But this is a first, and it was just an incredible stroke of luck. So interesting that there was two supernova firsts within a week of each other.
The good news was that seeing a supernova so early, earlier than any other supernova, it exonerated a lot of our predictions of what we would see. Mm-hmm. That's also the bad news, that no cool science really came out of it by seeing
nothing
it that early. But
yeah,
it was like bittersweet.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Bob. It confirmed what we thought, what we expected to see, which is nice from one perspective. But from another perspective, if we saw something totally unexpected, that would tell us that, hey, there's something going on here that we need to learn about. That would have opened up a new avenue of research. That always strikes me as profoundly naive when people who are criticizing quote unquote mainstream science say, or usually they're promoting some kind of wacky conspiracy theory, say that scientists don't like mysteries or don't like it when the data doesn't support their pre-existing belief systems, the status quo. They don't want to disrupt the status quo. It's like, nope, that's absolutely wrong. Scientists love it when the apple cart gets turned over because now they get to do a whole bunch of new research to figure out what's really going on.
Yeah, there could be a Nobel Prize in that anomaly.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, not to look over the fact that this does give us a huge amount of information that scientists can now deal with to go on to make further discoveries about supernova.
Yeah, not to downplay this at all. This is huge. This is great. For the last news item, we actually had the opportunity to talk to the scientist involved with the research. So let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Michael Schull. Michael, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
And Michael is a professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he was kind enough to join us this evening to discuss his latest research, which has been in the news really just today, Missing Matter of the Universe Found. Michael, why don't you quickly encapsulate for us what you found?
Well, we've been looking for so-called ordinary or baryonic matter that planets and stars are made of and humans too. We sort of know the target for what to go looking for from several sources. One is from studies of the microwave background, and the other is from nucleosynthesis out of the Big Bang. But anyway, suffice it to say that we were looking for ordinary matter. Up until now, we've only been able to account for about 10% of it in stars and galaxies, luminous matter. Mm-hmm. So there was about 90% of it that we had no idea where it was, although some suspicion that it was spread out in between the galaxies. So we went out looking with Hubble and another satellite called PUES, Far Ultraviolet Spectroscopic Explorer, using spectroscopy, basically taking the light from very distant objects, quasars, and as they shine through intergalactic space, everywhere there's some matter, some hydrogen gas, there would be some absorption lines, fingerprints, we call it. And we detected something like half. We found about half of this missing matter. That's good news. The glass is half full. But the bad news is we still haven't found the other half. There's still about 50% what we think is out there unaccounted for. That's a story for another day, maybe with a new space telescope. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that we think we found something like half the matter. Most of it strewn out in between the galaxies, millions of light years across, in what's called the intergalactic medium.
Hmm. And what relationship, or how does this affect our thinking of dark matter? Because my understanding was that that 90% that was missing has been collectively referred to as dark matter, just because it's not luminous, as you say, but that it actually is a different kind of matter. It's not baryonic. So is what you discovered eaten into that percentage of the universe that we think was quote-unquote dark matter?
No. The bookkeeping gets a little bit tricky, so let me summarize that briefly. The total mass energy content of the universe we call 100%. About 5% of it is this baryonic or ordinary matter, stuff we're made of.
Mm-hmm.
About 25% is this exotic dark matter. We have no idea what it is, but we know it's there. We can feel its gravity. And another 70% is something very, very exotic called dark energy that's repulsive. So I did my arithmetic, 5% plus 25% plus 70% adds up to 100%.
Okay.
So what we're talking about is going after the known stuff, that little 5% made of protons and neutrons, hydrogen, helium, all the heavy elements in the periodic table. We're going after that. We're leaving aside the dark matter, the non-baryonic or exotic dark matter. We have no way of finding that right now except feeling its gravity.
So in that 5%, we only knew where 10% of it was?
That's right. So okay. You think about it, you know, just a little tiny sliver of the pie shows up in the stuff we can see, stars, galaxies, clusters of galaxies.
And now your discovery has gotten us up to about 50%?
50% of the 5%.
Of the 5%, right.
Yeah,
okay.
A little bit tricky bookkeeping. Okay. That sounds really terrible. I mean, we don't know what 95% of the universe is, but unfortunately, that's how it is.
A lot of this baryonic matter that you're saying is in between galaxies, maybe in halos around galaxies. Why haven't the galaxies and clusters of galaxies just sucked this stuff in by now? Why is it still kind of in this baryonic haze around clusters and galaxies?
Well, you're right. There is a lot of matter in and around the halos of galaxies and clusters of galaxies. But the stuff we found is way farther away from galaxies than that. We're talking about stuff millions of light years away. I mean, they sort of very faintly feel the galaxy's gravity, but not much. You're out in intergalactic space. So it's sort of like saying, when do you have escape velocity from the Earth? If you flew out many astronomical units, millions of miles away from Earth, even though the gravity of Sun is still there, it's getting weaker and weaker. So we're talking about matter strewn millions of light years away from galaxies.
So they're not feeling much gravity at all?
Very little gravity except for these dark matter filaments. And in the press release, we showed some numerical or computational simulations of what we think is going on. The computers tell us that the dark matter isn't uniform. It ropes up or makes the spider web that we call the cosmic web. And the gravity of this dark matter in this web is what pulls the ordinary matter in, and that's what we think we saw.
Is most of this ordinary matter you discovered in the form of hydrogen gas?
Right. About 90%, maybe 92% is hydrogen. About another 7 or 8% is helium. And just little tiny traces are these heavy elements that are, of course, so important for life and planets, things like oxygen and carbon. And we saw that, too. We saw traces of things like carbon and oxygen and iron, silicon.
Where'd they come from?
They came from stars. So that's the other part of the story that the press release really didn't get too much into. But the heavy elements on beyond hydrogen and helium had to be forged in the furnaces
supernova.
Of supernova, and then blown up as supernova or stellar winds, and somehow blasted out into intergalactic space. So the fact that we found many of these filaments of intergalactic matter laced with these heavy elements that we almost surely came from stars tell us that intergalactic pollution has been pretty strong. There's been a lot of supernova and galactic outflows that polluted intergalactic space.
Mike, how surprising were these results? I mean, did you kind of expect to find something along these lines, or did this totally take you by surprise?
It wasn't a total surprise, I have to be honest. When you go looking with an expensive, powerful instrument like Hubble, You have to plan these observations. You have to convince your colleagues that they're worth doing. So we wrote some proposals over, well, this is really 3 years of work. We had some suspicions that this intergalactic space, this vast near vacuum, was full of all these things. And so we convinced our colleagues and spent 3 years taking the data and analyzing it. But the exciting thing is, you know, if you ask me what really excites me, in October, NASA is going to install a new instrument, a new spectrograph on Hubble that we build at Colorado along with Ball Aerospace. And in October, November, somewhere in that time frame, what we used to take, say, 10 orbits of Hubble time to do, we can do in one orbit. It's just that much more powerful of a spectrograph.
What's the next big question about this that you need to answer?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, several questions. We only looked in 28 different directions. Sounds like a lot, but there's a lot of regions of space that we didn't look at. So with this new instrument, we're going to look at maybe 100 quasars, 100 little core samples of intergalactic space, and maybe get 10,000 of these filaments of the cosmic web. We're going to try to analyze what they're made of, where they're located in intergalactic space, look farther away because our instruments are more powerful. It's really just exploring what the nearest 4 or 5 billion light years looks like. I call it local, but
what's the temperature of this gas? I've read claims of high temperatures, which is kind of a little surprising.
Well, it's all over the place. There's gas that's maybe we call it warm. It's only maybe 5 or 10,000 degrees Kelvin or centigrade. That's fairly warm gas. But then we found evidence of gas that's almost 1 million degrees. And you ask, well, how does it get that hot? Shockwaves or sonic booms.
Wow.
The gravity of this dark matter pulls the gas in, and it pulls it in, and it becomes supersonic, and then it makes a shock, like much like a sonic boom. And that shockwave is what heats it up to 500,000 or 1 million degrees.
Is it technically a plasma then?
It's exactly a plasma. It's almost completely ionized, not entirely. And wow, what we saw in the really hot gas was oxygen, ordinary oxygen, that had been stripped of all but three of its outer electrons. So it's a very high ionized state of oxygen. And that's what we detected in the ultraviolet.
What's the future of this gas? What's going to happen to it, or I guess what's already happened to it since it's so far away? It's already happened. We just haven't seen it yet. But what's it going to be like?
Well, again, we rely on the computer models that tell us, assuming that gravity works the way we think it works, gravity is going to slowly pull this gas inward along the filaments. You know, think of a spider web, and where the filaments intersect along the web is where the galaxies are. You know, much like a black widow spider sitting at the center of the web, the gravity is going to pull that matter inward toward the spider. It will rain in on the galaxy. It will make more stars, presumably. The galaxies will get bigger. So we're watching galaxies assemble before our eyes.
Wow.
But on 1 million light year time scale or distance scale. Galaxy formation is going on today. Not everything happened 10 billion years ago. It's still going on. Right in our own Milky Way, we're in a local group of galaxies with maybe 40 or so galaxies, but two or three big ones. The two biggest ones, Andromeda and the Milky Way, are pulling toward each other, falling toward each other because of gravity. In about 2.5 or 3 billion years, they're going to start going through each other, merging. So a lot's happening on a billion-year timescale.
Well, Michael Schull, thank you very much for explaining your research to us.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
Okay, a couple of emails before we go on to our interviews. First email comes from Hirsch Leff from the United States, who writes, "My favorite rogues, I was paired up to play golf with a Baptist pastor who had attended Bob Jones University. Although a nice guy, he really believes that Bible thing. He said he was going to pray for me, but I wonder. As we were packing our cars, he commented on how hot it was outside, and I remarked that I guess I had better get used to that. Anyway, he brought up a story that I don't remember hearing before. He said that scientists were wrong about the age of Mount St. Helens. Here is a link that describes his story. Please provide a reference for where this story came from, and I will print it off and mail it to him at his church. My 14-year-old son and I look forward to meeting you all in Las Vegas next month. Thanks." Well, thanks, Hirsch. We look forward to meeting you as well.
Bringing a 14-year-old to Vegas? You are going to hell, Hirsch. Awesome.
So, Bob, you looked into this one. This is basically one of those just creationist stories that, you know, the creationists won't give up simply because it's wrong, and they claim that if you use dating methods on Mount St. Helens, which we know what the date of the lava
right.
there is, it's only 20 years old. The dating is wrong. So they're using this to try to call into question radiometric dating methods. Tell us more about that, Bob.
Yeah, and that's their name. Their main goal is to try to knock down, you know, one of the gold standards of science for dating methods. There's a quote on the website that Hirsch links to that says radioisotope dating is widely perceived to be the gold standard of dating methods and the proof for millions of years of Earth history. But when the method is tested on rocks of known age, it fails miserably. So the idea that's laid out on the website is that there was a trip to Mount St. Helens by the author Keith Swenson, who was the president of the Design Science Association, which is based in Oregon and promotes an oxymoron called scientific creationist evidences. He went there with some members from the Institute of Creation Research to Mount St. Helens, and there's a lava dome there, a 1,000-foot-high lava dome that we know solidified in the 80s after the eruption. And so we know what the age is. And they apparently got some of the rock and they did some radiometric dating on it. And it said that age of the rock is 0.35 to 2.8 million years old, which is obviously wrong. Therefore, radiometric dating or potassium argon dating in this case is useless. Therefore, the Earth cannot be billions of years old, and therefore evolution is baloney, and lots of other therefores. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of problems. I mean, on the surface, it seems like, whoa, this is an anomaly. What's going on here? But of course, if you just do a little bit of research, you know that there really isn't a problem there.
Tell us a little bit first, Bob, about just give us the quick background on the potassium argon dating method.
Potassium argon dating is one of the forms of radiometric dating. That compares a naturally occurring radioactive isotope and the products it decays into using known decay rates. There's multiple versions of this. Potassium argon is one, radiocarbon is another, and uranium lead dating is another one. Potassium argon has potassium as the parent element, and its daughter element or decay product is argon. And using the ratio between those two, you can determine the age. And it's very good in certain applications. It's beautiful for dating. But of course, scientists never use it as the only way to age something. Most of the time, they're looking for, you know, corroborating evidence that lines up with the potassium argon dating. And the problem with potassium argon dating in some applications is that you should not use it on rocks that are, say, under 100,000 years because of argon contamination. Sometimes some materials will have not a zero amount of argon. It will start off with a certain level of argon, which completely contaminates any measurement you're trying to read, because initially you're assuming that there's potassium and no argon, and then less potassium and more argon, and changing the ratio so that you could determine what the date is. So it takes actually many, many years before this contaminated argon is small enough in comparison to the true daughter argon so that any dating is actually contains valuable information for you. And these people are, of course, I guess they're not aware of this. They're using potassium argon dating in an invalid way. And also there's other claims that even the testing facility that they used itself has contaminations of argon that completely throws off any dating technique. So they're doubly wrong.
Yeah, and in fact, in this particular laboratory that they used, they say that there's contamination from prior samples, for example. And the 100,000 years, though, Bob, that you gave, so in other words, you shouldn't use potassium argon dating for samples less than 100,000 years old. That's for the state-of-the-art, really accurate equipment. This laboratory, with their equipment, they said that you shouldn't analyze samples less than 2 million years old, which is relevant because all the dates that were given on these samples pretty much were less than 2 million years old. So they were within the error bars for this lab.
Yeah. They don't care. They just don't care. I don't think there's any evidence that you could that would sway them in their beliefs. And they're just trying, as usual, they're trying to say, look, science, they're trying to use science to their to their benefit, and when they think it could help them, and otherwise they, you know,
right,
that doesn't matter. Like, oh, you know, science, bah.
Bob, I plugged in the words radioisotope dating accurate into Google search. Here's the first page. Here's where it directs me to: ChristianAnswers.net, AnswersInGenesis.org, ReligiousTolerance.org. We got the ICR, which you mentioned, Bob.org. So right there on page one, half of the entries lead you right to the junk.
Yeah, basically creationist sites trying to knock down the radiometric dating methods. But yeah, but it's, in this case, this guy Austin doesn't know what he's doing. He did crappy science. All he proved was that he doesn't know what he's doing, not that the potassium-argon method is not valid. Well, let's move on to our interview. Joining us now is Carl Zimmer. Carl, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And Carl is a biologist and a science writer who has written a number of books, including Evolution, the Triumph of an Idea, as well as one that I'm particularly interested in, Soul Made Flesh, the Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. But we're going to be talking to him mostly this evening about his latest book, which is just coming out this month, called Microcosm, E. Coli and the New Science of Life. Carl, before we get to the book, I wanted to ask you first how you came to be a popular science writer.
Yeah, well, I should actually start out by saying I am not, in fact, a biologist, but I do love biology. I started out as an English major who happened to like taking science classes, and a couple years out of college, I got a job at Discover Magazine, just starting out fact-checking and things like that, and realized that I really loved it, and I haven't looked back.
So you came to science from writing rather than writing from science?
Yes. There are a lot of science writers who started out getting training as scientists or, you know, having been professional scientists and started to take up writing. I've gone the other way, and there are a lot of us out there too, English majors and such, who just happen to love science.
Was this a lifelong love affair with science that you had, or did you discover it later in life?
It was something I didn't really think that consciously about. When I look back, sort of in hindsight, it seems kind of obvious. I mean, I was getting Scientific American in high school. I don't think I was really quite aware that you could be a science writer. It's just something that didn't come on the radar. And so in college, I would be writing a lot of fiction, and it just so happens that a lot of it had sort of certain scientific themes to it, but it really took someone just whacking me over the head with a very large hammer for me to realize that this would be something I'd like to do.
They said, hey, you love science, why don't you write about that? And then it was, the light went on?
Yeah, I had this job, and I was realizing that, you know, every day I was learning something that I never would have guessed before, and part of that learning involved calling people up and just being able to ask them really stupid questions, you know, mm-hmm. So I could call up a scientist, a world expert in some area, and just have what to me felt like a private tutoring. I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah, most scientists are really happy to talk about their work. It's often hard to get them to shut up, actually.
They are. It's a different kind of writing than a lot of journalism. I mean, people who write about politics very often have the subjects of their articles doing everything they can not to talk to them. Mm-hmm. Whereas with me, people are just very generous. I like to write about surprising kinds of biology, and so I end up talking to biologists who do not actually get talked to by journalists all that often. So they're kind of surprised that anyone would be interested in what they're doing, and they're pleased with that. So that helps too.
So regarding your latest book, Microcosm, how did you come to the decision to write an entire book about E. coli?
Well, in a sense, it's really a book about life, and that's how it started out in my mind. I had been writing a lot of articles and a lot of blog posts about some really deep questions about life. I mean, what is life? What does it mean to be alive? What are the rules that life has to follow? Are there rules that life has to follow on Earth as well as on other planets if there is life out there? What was interesting to me was that scientists were really starting to take these kinds of questions to a new level. I mean, these are not new questions, but today biologists know so much about the workings of life. I mean, they have hundreds of genomes at their fingertips that they can analyze. They can see individual molecules moving around inside of cells. They can discover life in incredibly remote places on Earth, and they can reconstruct their evolution in amazing ways. But I realized that writing about just life as a book would be kind of a crazy proposition. You know, it would be a 10,000-page monster. So I tried to think of a way to focus it. And I remember just driving along a very long, empty stretch of the New Jersey Turnpike and just turning things over in my head. And it dawned on me that just about everything that I was reading about, in one way or another, involved E. coli. Because E. coli has been this favorite organism of scientists for decades. They keep coming back to it with all of these questions. And then I realized that if I wrote a kind of a natural history of E. coli, if I wrote a biography of E. coli, I would be telling this story of what we understand about life.
Yeah, I remember you saying that or writing that in stuff I've read of yours, that, and the name of the book obviously implies the same thing as well, that you could focus on any tiny little bit of biology and that would uncover, you know, most of what we know, or all the concepts will be wrapped up in any tiny slice you choose to take a look at.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about E. coli is that it's this incredibly well-studied organism. I mean, about a dozen Nobel Prizes were won by people who studied E. coli, and they discovered some really profound things about life. They discovered the genetic code with E. coli. They discovered how genes are turned on and off with E. coli. Yeah, there's nothing terribly unusual about E. coli. The one reason that scientists picked it was because it was easy to use. It grows well in oxygen, and it's harmless, or at least most strains of E. coli are harmless, and the ones the scientists use are harmless, and they are off to the races. But it was this strange snowball effect, so that now scientists know so much more about E. coli than about just about any other species on Earth, and that's actually led to all sorts of surprising things. So, for example, genetic engineering and biotechnology is all really built on mainly on E. coli. People started tinkering with the genes of E. coli first in the 1970s and built this whole biotechnology industry, and they're still using E. coli to push it even further.
Yeah, and since we haven't said it yet, just for our listeners who may not know, E. coli is a bacteria, so it's among the simplest forms of life that there are. And you know, what you're saying is that scientists learned a lot about E. coli because it was something that they used to study life. So just it's a laboratory creature, if you will.
Well, and also what's important is that a lot of the rules of life actually are quite widespread. So scientists first figured out the genetic code in E. coli, that is, how it is that the genes are, the code in the sequence of genes in DNA is used to create proteins. There's a little, it's code, it's like almost like a French-English dictionary in a sense. Well, then the scientists went and looked at other species and discovered it's basically the same dictionary that all living things are using. All living things switch their genes on and off as well. All living things do a lot of the same things that E. coli does. And so there's this very famous quote that a French biologist who studied E. coli gave once. He said, "What is true for E. coli is true for the elephant." In the sense that if you find something interesting in E. coli, chances are that you're going to find it in other things as well.
Carl, what I found most interesting when I saw you talk last week at Harvard was when you were talking about things that I feel like recently, up until recently, we thought would have only applied to even just humans, but now you're finding in something as simple as E. coli, like altruism. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I find it absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So E. coli and other bacteria actually have quite a social life. I mean, we think of them as these kind of mindless loners just sitting there feeding and dividing and in some cases making us sick, or in some cases, you know, turning food, you know, turning milk into yogurt or something. But in fact, bacteria are very social. They communicate with each other a lot. They cooperate. So E. coli, for example, that live in your gut, they are building these little microbial cities. They're called biofilms, and they're these huge aggregations of bacteria that they produce this kind of sticky glue that has them all kind of hang together. And it's a cooperative effort. It takes work, and it takes them all to kind of synchronize what they're doing and switch hundreds of genes on and off in harmony. This even goes as far as to altruism, as you say. And I think the most dramatic case of this is what happens when a colony of E. coli starts to run out of food, and maybe it's competing with another colony of E. coli nearby. In times of stress, what happens is that a few of the E. coli in a particular colony will start producing a toxin inside of them, and they sort of build up with it inside them, and they swell with this toxin until they just explode. So they die. They kill themselves producing this poison, which then showers all the surrounding bacteria, and it kills the E. coli from the other colony. The members of their own colony survive, and it's this remarkable antidote that each E. coli makes to its own toxin that protects them. So you have this case where bacteria are sacrificing themselves for the good of the whole colony. If you are killing yourself, in a sense, your genes may not be killed off in the process. That's the basic logic of it. But it turns out to be really complicated, because as soon as a mutation pops up in one E. coli, it's different from the rest of its colony, slightly different. And so these differences are constantly evolving, even within a colony. And so there seems to be this very subtle trade-off between selfishness and selflessness, that even in a colony of bacteria, which we think is really simple, can actually be very complex. I mean, we've talked here a couple times about how E. coli is simple, and I come away from this book thinking, well, they're not really all that simple. I mean, they've got 4,000 genes, they've got all of these sensory systems, they've got this remarkable way of navigating, their genes are organized in ways that kind of parallel how, you know, a circuit is organized, how the internet is organized. So their evolution is following the similar principles that engineers follow. It's just a remarkable critter.
But even beyond that, I was surprised that I read your article in the New York Times, and one of the things that surprised me was the variability within an E. coli colony of clones. Was really surprising. Could you describe a little bit about this variability among the clones and the reasons for it? Even though the DNA is identical, you explained how they really are individuals, even with identical DNA.
Yeah, this I just found really fascinating, and it gets at something that we take for granted. We think of genes as being kind of our ultimate identity, so that our genes are who we are. And yet, you can have two E. coli that are totally genetically identical. I mean, they are clones of each other, literally. And yet, they may behave in response to the same situation in totally different ways. One of the classic studies of this has to do with how E. coli swim. They've got these sort of corkscrew-shaped tails that are driven by these little motor-like proteins that spin around hundreds of times a second. And they respond to basically smells, to molecules that touch them and latch onto certain receptors. And they will swim longer in a particular direction if they smell something good. But if you give two of these clones the same smell, one might swim twice as far as the other one. The other one just sort of gives up after a while. There are all these other examples where they will produce the enzymes for breaking down some kind of sugar. One will produce them if the sugar's around, one won't. They'll produce sort of sticky hair-like molecules on their surface that let them stick onto other surfaces. Well, some make them, and some just kind of go bald. There are all these kinds of differences. So E. coli are really individuals, incredibly. And it turns out that those differences arise because life is more than just a genome. It's more than just a code in your DNA. It's the DNA, and it's all the proteins that are the DNA is making and that are controlling the DNA, and it's other molecules as well. And it's kind of a noisy, sort of sloppy process in there inside of a cell.
Carl, is there something that really sticks out for you that was like the most surprising thing you learned about E. coli when you were researching this book?
I think I was surprised at just how wide you could cast a net with the help of E. coli. I thought it would be a pretty good idea for a book, but I was really blown away by just all the different aspects of life. So, for example, I'm really interested in astrobiology, you know, the search for life on other planets. I think it's a really interesting question. And it turns out that E. coli, of all things, is wrapped up with all of that. So, for example, the whole science of astrobiology got its start thanks to an E. coli biologist named Joshua Lederberg. So he won the Nobel Prize for discovering that E. coli has sex, that one microbe will trade genes with another microbe, and you can use that as a tool to figure out how genes are organized by just letting them go back and forth between these microbes. He went to Australia on sabbatical, and he happened to be there, I guess, one night looking up, and there went Sputnik up into the air, up into space. And he suddenly said, wow, I have to think seriously about what this means for me as a biologist. And what he decided was that basically he had to invent a new kind of science called exobiology. And he took a lot of the stuff that he learned with E. coli and used that to just set up a whole way of thinking about how you look for life on other planets. And today, his, you know, intellectual grandchildren are still using E. coli to think about life on other planets. You know, one of the big questions about whether there's life elsewhere is, what should we be looking for? Should we only look for DNA-based life? Should we only look for life that uses the same 20 amino acids that life on Earth uses to build proteins? There are scientists who are basically monkeying around with E. coli to try to get it into forms that no living thing has ever had before on Earth. So, for example, they've changed the amino acids that it uses to build proteins. It turns out that, you know, it does fine. It says, you want to give me a new amino acid that no living thing uses to build proteins? I can handle it. They changed the alphabet of its genes, what are called the nucleotides. I mean, all life uses 4 nucleotides in its DNA. They've thrown in other nucleotides, and E. coli does fine. So E. coli is sort of helping to expand our notion of what life on other planets might be like. So that I found really surprising.
How long have we been living a symbiotic relationship with them? I mean, is it since mammals existed, or?
Yes, most likely. Our ancestors, early primate ancestors had E. coli or something very much like E. coli. All warm-blooded animals appear to be able to carry E. coli, so that's birds and mammals. And then when scientists look at the DNA of all the E. coli strains, they can estimate when their common ancestor lived. The estimate is roughly like 30 million years ago. But, you know, it's not just E. coli that we've had this relationship with. I mean, there are hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 species of bacteria and other microbes just in our guts. And then there are lots more in our skin, in our mouth, and so on, that we have this very complicated relationship with. And so E. coli is just one species in that big jungle.
What would happen if all of a sudden somebody didn't have any living E. coli in their body? How would you simply just die of starvation? Or
no, you wouldn't die of starvation if you lost E. coli. For one thing, you'd probably pick it up pretty fast again. Your bacteria are moving in and out of our system all the time. There are other species of bacteria that live in our guts that we really need, and we really don't do very well without. I suppose if you were to somehow suddenly wipe out all the bacteria in your gut at once, that you could really have a nasty experience, but that's such a it's such a hypothetical thing. I mean, you'd really have to work at that to totally sterilize your gut. I mean, we do depend on these bacteria very much, and E. coli, it may provide us with a few nutrients that we can't break down ourselves, but it actually may have another beneficial effect on us that's a lot subtler. It's more like an ecological effect. E. coli uses oxygen, and it uses it up, and by getting rid of the oxygen, it makes the conditions inside better for bacteria that don't use oxygen. It lowers the oxygen levels, and it's those bacteria that don't like oxygen that really help us out a lot. So it's this really complicated ecosystem that we've got inside of us and that we depend on.
Yeah, in addition, they keep out unfriendly bacteria,
right,
and other organisms.
That's right.
So, you know, if when people take antibiotics and they do largely suppress their normal intestinal flora, they will get other infections. Other bacteria that are resistant to those antibiotics, for example, will take over, and you can get quite a nasty infection.
That's right. And there are strains of E. coli that in Europe are given to babies sometimes who are having intestinal problems. They're called probiotics, and what they appear to do is they appear to colonize the gut really aggressively but not make the baby sick. What they do is this particular kind of E. coli prevents other disease-causing strains of bacteria from invading.
What about, extrapolate that a little bit, what if at some point we could genetically engineer E. coli and then introduce them to do all sorts of novel things that we might find helpful?
People have been engineering E. coli to do novel things for 30 years now. So the first genetically engineered organism that became a commercial application was E. coli carrying a human gene for insulin. It used to be that diabetics could only get their insulin from pancreases of pigs, I believe, pigs and cows. Now a lot of people get it from E. coli that's churning out human insulin because it's got the gene. Today, scientists have gone a lot further with their engineering of E. coli. So instead of just like a single gene making a single protein, they are adding a whole new circuits of genes to make E. coli do all kinds of interesting things. Just in the news, E. coli was engineered by some undergraduates, actually, to solve a classic
burnt pancake problem.
That's right, the burnt pancake problem, where you figure out how many times you have to flip a stack of pancakes to get them into a certain arrangement. Other people have made E. coli that will flash all sorts of rainbows of colors. Some people have made E. coli that will smell like spearmint while they're growing rapidly as a colony, and then when they stop growing rapidly, they smell like banana. Right now, there's a lot of this is just in the fooling around stage, but it could potentially have some really powerful applications. So, for example, one thing that researchers at the University of California in San Francisco are looking into is engineering E. coli so that it can, you put it into someone's body and it basically sniffs out cancer tumors.
Yeah.
Finds the cancer tumors and then it can invade them. And once it knows that it's inside, it basically blows itself up and produces lots of toxins. So you just take genes from different species that do these different kinds of tasks, combine them together, and then hopefully you've created this torpedo.
So you think we'd be able to bioengineer E. coli, like to be more efficient at doing some of the things that they do for us?
You mean in our guts?
Yeah.
It's possible, sure. I mean, a lot of what scientists are doing now with E. coli is called metabolic engineering. So what they're doing is not so much adding alien genes to their genome, but they are sort of tweaking their metabolism in order to boost the production of certain molecules that E. coli makes. So you can definitely imagine that people trying to engineer their metabolism to affect the way they perform in our guts, but I would be skeptical if they would be successful because, as we were just saying, the function of these microbes in our guts is the result of this incredibly complex ecosystem.
Well, Jay just wants his farts to smell like bananas.
Okay. That we can do.
Good
luck.
You
know, it was a weird realization I don't know how many years ago, but it was a weird realization when I read that all of our gas comes from them. It's not really from us.
Well, they are us.
Yeah, that's right. You're a host.
Symbiotic relationship.
Exactly. But if you were to like count up the number of genes, if you were to like someone were to like grind you up and just count all the genes in you, most of the genes would be not yours. They would not be human genes.
Right.
So yeah, we're infrastructure.
Right. Well, Carl, we really appreciate you giving us your time. It was a fascinating talk.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And I hope we can have you back again. There's just so much more to talk about, including I do want to at some point maybe talk to you about your neurology book, because that's a topic I'm obviously interested in.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to. Happy to.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Thanks, Carl.
Right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Good talking to everybody.
This is a bit of an unusual episode this week because we ended up with three interviews. We spoke earlier in the week with Jeff Wagg to give us an update on TAM6. So let's hear that interview now. Joining us now is Jeff Wagg from the James Randi Educational Foundation. Jeff, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me back.
And Jeff is going to give us a brief interview tonight just to get us updated on the Amazing Meeting 6. So, Jeff, give us the update.
Well, things are going great. We have a new venue this year. We're at the Flamingo, which is right at the heart of the Strip. It's the nicest hotel we've ever had a TAM at, very big with lots of stuff to do outside and right across the street from everything. So we're very excited about it. It's a really nice room this year. And for those that remember last year, I guarantee you the bathrooms are very close to the action this year, so that we won't have that 900-mile-long walk. And we've also got some really great speakers this year. The keynote speaker is Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson of NOVA and the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He's very well known. He's going to be giving us an amazing talk, and we're really looking forward to that.
He is excellent.
Yes. We have Michael Shermer coming back, of course, Adam Savage from the Mythbusters, Richard Wiseman's coming back, Penn and Teller. There's some unusual guy from Connecticut who's going to be speaking. His name is Novella or something.
Bob Novella.
He weaseled his way in there, huh?
Yeah, sometimes we just have to have some filler people, you understand. But no, I'm just teasing. I know that Steve's talk has been very well received, and we're looking forward to having it at TAM. We also have some other new folks who we haven't had in the past. PZ Myers of Pharyngula will be there.
He'll have a lot to say, and, especially with
he's going to be a lot of fun. I'm sure he's going to make fun of Phil Plait, which we always welcome, and Phil will be there as well. And we have Matthew Chapman. Now, there's a name that you might not recognize, but what he is the great-grandson of Charles Darwin.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And actually, I think he's the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin. But he has a lot of interesting stories to tell, and we're really looking forward to having him, especially in light of the fact that many of us are going to the Galapagos in August. You'll have some insight there. Yeah, Sharon Begley is a science editor for Newsweek magazine. We've been reading her stuff for a while now, and we're really excited to have her. She's going to be a lot of fun. And then for shows, we have some really cool people for shows. We're doing stuff a little different this year. We have a whole bunch of different kinds of shows. On Thursday night, we have Dr. Art Benjamin, who is doing science with math. This is one of those whiz kid guys. Like, you say, hey, tell me pi to 100,000 places, and he'll just rattle them off,
right.
Things like that. His show is stunning, and he can only be with us Thursday, unfortunately, so this is the only chance to see him at TAM is to go to his show Thursday night. We have Banachek and Ben Radford doing workshops for us. Banachek's going to do something a little different. He's not giving us a show. He's actually going to work with a group of people to master mnemonic memory, because he has a number of tricks for that. And Ben Radford has a really cool workshop called The Real X-Files, Scientific Paranormal Investigations. Mm-hmm. And that'll be a lot of fun. Those are scheduled in such a way that you can actually take both. And then for fun, we have George Frabb and Graydon Square doing a double feature music night. Very different kinds of music. George Frabb is kind of rock and roll, a little bit folk sometimes, very skeptical. And Graydon Square is hip-hop, rap, and they're going to work well together. this is going to be a really cool PAM. I'm very excited that we have these new people coming.
Yeah, we've been talking about it for a long time. We're all really looking forward to it. And, of course, our listeners know that we're going to be having breakfast with the SGU Friday and Saturday morning, where we're going to record some live shows, dinner with the SGU Friday night.
I do have a couple of other interesting things that we've never done at TAM before that we're going to do this year.
Okay.
We're going to be selling chocolate, and it's chocolate in the shape of flying pigs. Now, this is very high-quality chocolate. It is worth buying just for chocolate's sake. However, in one of the boxes, there will be basically a golden ticket.
A la Willy Wonka.
A la Willy Wonka. Someone is going to get very lucky and win something fabulous, some one-of-a-kind item as yet to be announced. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And the way that will work is we're going to sell the chocolate all up until the break on Saturday afternoon, at which point we'll announce who has won the one with the golden ticket, because if the first person to buy the box got the golden ticket, that would really affect our chocolate sales.
Yes.
The other thing is that I have heard a rumor that Richard Wiseman is up to something very, very special that will involve some audience participation this year.
But he's not given any details yet?
No. No, he won't give me any details. He's being very secretive, but he's saying that the audience is in for a real treat, and this is definitely a year that they shouldn't miss.
It's some kind of a psychological experiment, or he's not even really being that specific yet?
It could be. It could be something else. No, he's not being specific at all, but he's very, very, very excited about it. So Richard has been our top speaker for the last couple of years, and if he's excited about something, I'm sure it's going to be something really cool.
Yeah, he's always a pleasure to watch. He's just a very interesting, entertaining guy who really knows his stuff and really understands the connection between psychology and skepticism. Just an amazing lecturer.
Yeah, he's great. I really enjoy him. And on Sunday, we're going to have our paper presentations as always. We haven't figured out exactly who that's going to be, but the competition in past years has been very heated, and this year has been really heated. We're getting to the point now where we could have a whole conference just of paper presentations. And every year the quality is been better and better. Another one of these novella guys did one last year, I think, and it was very well received.
So, Jeff, tell us, how can our listeners sign up and go to TAM6?
Well, you can always go to theamazingmeeting.com, and that will have all of our latest offerings. That will have the Amazing Meeting and the cruises that we do. And we're going to announce the next cruise at TAM. Galapagos is sold out. We'll announce the next one at TAM. On that site, you can register online and pay online using PayPal. Or if you're old-fashioned and just want to talk to somebody, you can always call the JREF at 954-467-1112 and ask for Linda. If she's not there, someone else can help you. But Linda is the one who makes this all work, and we worship her.
Right. And this is June 19th to 22nd in Vegas, Nevada.
Right at the Flamingo, right in the heart. You can't get any more Las Vegas than this.
You really can't. Caesar's Palace across the street. I mean, you're really right there in the middle of the
Bally's, area. Paris, Bellagio, all within walking distance. It literally is right there. Don't rent a car. You won't need it. Although I should add, if you do want to rent a car, because some people are heading out to Death Valley and Red Rocks and things like that, there is a discount. Geez, I forget the name of the company, but we have a discount on our website for a certain company. So if you go to theamazingmeeting.com and look through the registration, you'll see there's a link there to get discounts on rented cars.
And, well, thanks for coming on and giving us the update, Jeffrey. We are all looking forward to it tremendously.
Thanks for having me, and I will see you there.
All right, see you there.
Thanks, Jeff.
Take care.
Okay.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of esteemed skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. The theme this week is biology. So these are just all biological stuff. And here we go. Item number one. Researchers have found that capsaicin, the chemical that makes chili peppers hot, is an effective treatment for erectile dysfunction. Item number two. A new study shows that the scales of a Brazilian beetle have the optimal structure for optical computing. And item number three, genetic researchers have identified a gene that determines musical aptitude.
Steve, you have an uncanny ability at finding news items that I absolutely didn't read.
Jay, why don't you go first?
Of course. Well, we all know what capsaicin is. I think it's pretty funny to think that it would help men get boners.
God.
I mean, it is. Rebecca, admit it.
Well, I just appreciate your use of the scientific term, boner.
Right.
A boner, right? Okay. Right.
You know, it just occurred to me. I didn't write this in there, but I'm talking about oral use, not topical.
Oh, yeah. See, I was picturing like a pepper spray sort of thing.
Right.
It kind of invalidates my rape alarm kit.
So if Rebecca goes out for a Mexican, you know, a really spicy Mexican meal, we know what's going to end up at the end of the day, right? All right. So, okay, we got it. All right. Does it work? Does it not work? There's only one way to find out. And then we got a study that shows the scales of a Brazilian beetle have the optimal structure for optical computing. And then got these genetic researchers that identified a gene that has determined musical aptitude. That seems to make sense. And I'm going to say that one is the fake, though, the one about the musical aptitude.
Okay. Evan?
Okay. So capsaicin, chemical that makes chili peppers hot, effective treatment for erectile dysfunction. Okay. And then the Brazilian beetle, the optimal structure for optical computing. Boy, that's interesting. That's too interesting to not be true. And I'm inclined to agree with Jay. I think the musical aptitude one doesn't strike a chord with me, so I'll say that is fiction.
Okay. Rebecca?
Oh, man. Well, yeah, I can see capsaicin activating certain nerves or something like that. So that makes sense. The beetle helping out with optical computing, you know, we've heard similar things where biological traits have helped technological advances, but it seems, I haven't heard anything about it. It seems a little fishy. Identifying a gene that determines musical aptitude, that sounds familiar-ish to me. So I feel like maybe that one is true. So I'm actually going to go against the grain, and I'm going to go with the beetle thing as being fiction.
Okay, Bob?
See, the beetle one actually sounds plausible to me. A lot of times beetle shells, you could have the show the colors, all the different colors of light, like oil, like oil on water in, say, a parking lot, that iridescence or thin film interference. So I could see that it could somehow manipulate light in such a way that it would be helpful for optical computing. The capsaicin one, nothing's jumping out at me for that one. It seems plausible.
jumping out at you.
Nothing's poking you on that one?
Nothing's popping up?
Poking me. Nope.
Bob, is that a hard one to answer?
Nothing's tickling your fancy?
Be careful, you might get the shaft on this one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, I knew Bob, I was in for trouble when I included that
shut
one.
Shut your mouth.
Yeah.
Bob, sorry. Don't go down on this one.
Come on, have some balls.
Wow. A single gene for musical aptitude, I'm having problems with that. But I'm going to take a chance and go with one as being fiction, the capsaicin as fiction.
Okay, so you guys are all over the place.
Can I change mine?
Ew.
No.
Well, once Bob said the thing about it being a single gene, I think he might be right. Anyway.
It's too obvious.
Well, we'll see.
Anyway, so you want to switch from 2 to 3? Is that what you're saying?
I think I would, yeah.
You can't switch. I'm just curious as to which way you would switch if you could. Well, let's take these in order. Researchers have found that capsaicin, the chemical that makes chili peppers hot, is an effective treatment for erectile dysfunction. You guys all bought this except for Bob, and this one is the fiction.
Woohoo!
Bob got it right.
Wow, Bob.
Nice, Bob.
Thank you.
You were all over that one.
Jeez.
Bob, you're going to have to high-five yourself.
So this was inspired by a news item that basically involves three-dimensionally mapping the protein receptor for capsaicin. This is the TRPV1 receptor. And this is a channel, an ion channel, so it's responsible for nerve conduction. And this channel is involved with the sensation of burning or painful sensation. So when in capsaicin, you know, the chemical that makes chili peppers hot, activates this receptor. So it actually is burning. You know, when you say that this food is hot, that actually makes sense because it's actually activating the same receptor that feels heat and pain. So, and the whole bit about erectile dysfunction I completely made up.
Well, I think that, wait, but are you sure? You know?
Yeah, well, as sure as I could be. I've been searching for a negative.
Have you tried it, Steve?
Hey.
Yeah, did you do a study?
No, anecdotal evidence is not acceptable. Mm. Number two, a new study shows that the scales of a Brazilian beetle have the optimal structure for optical computing. And Bob, you got this one exactly correct. This beetle has a green iridescent outer carapace. Now, this all has to do with the quest for the photonic crystal. Have you heard about that before, Bob?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So for optical computing, using light, beams of light instead of electrons to compute, which is one of the lines of research to try to get to the next phase of super fast computing, because light based computers would be 1,000 times faster than the computers that we're using today.
For certain applications.
So this is something that they're actively working on because, for the implications for computer hardware. In order to do that, we need a substance that can manipulate light the way we need it to. And what they're looking for is a photonic crystal that will be able to manipulate visible light by impeding certain frequencies of light and not others. So it's like selectively allowing light to pass through. That's what they need to have happen. And they haven't been able to manufacture a photonic crystal. It turns out that they've known for a while that a diamond has the perfect structure that they need, that the arrangement of carbon atoms in a diamond are perfect to behave like a photonic crystal. The problem is that the carbon atoms are too tightly packed in order for it to behave the way we need for visible light. So they need something that has a diamond-like structure, just looser. Well, it turns out that this beetle, this Brazilian beetle that has this green iridescence, has its scales made of chitin and certain proteins in a crystalline structure that is the diamond structure. It's that exact structure, but it's just much bigger, and it's at a size that is a photonic crystal in the visible light spectrum. So it's exactly what we've been looking for, already made for us by nature. So whether or not this could be adapted to actually being used for technological applications remains to be seen, but it's certainly a useful discovery. It also goes beyond computing, Bob. They may be able to use these types of substances to make much more efficient solar panels, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe lots of other applications as well.
Cool. Excellent.
Well, let's go on to item number three. Genetic researchers have identified a gene that determines musical aptitude, and that is science.
Wow.
Fascinating.
Although, keep in mind, I didn't say the gene that determines music, just a gene. There are probably others as well. This is a result of a Finnish study. They looked at 15 Finnish families, and they basically tested their music aptitude. They used some standardized testing for auditory structuring ability and the Seashore pitch and time discrimination subtests. Have you guys ever taken that, by the way?
No.
No.
Twice.
So, yeah, basically figuring out just what their raw musical neurological aptitude was, and because they're families, they could do genetic analysis to try to see like which genes go along with the better musical ability, and they found a specific gene that is very tightly tied to musical ability. There were other genetic variants which are much more loosely tied, so they have a much weaker influence. But there was just one particular one that had a very dominant influence on it. Again, this doesn't mean they're not going to discover other genes. This is something as complex as musical ability is not going to be a single gene, Mendelian inheritance. Well, Jay, give us the quote this week, and remember, we're doing the name of the person after the quote.
What do you think I'm stupid?
Yes.
Yes.
Go.
Stupid is as stupid does.
I had full intentions of not mentioning...
Just a gentle reminder. It's a new thing. It's all about the new way.
The person who happened to have said or written this thing I'm about to read. So I got it. Thank you.
Got it.
But I am going to tell you about the person before I read the quote. This person was born in 1908, died in 1974, and was a British mathematician of Polish-Jewish origin. Man masters nature not by force, but by understanding. That is why science has succeeded where magic failed, because it has looked for no spell to cast on nature. Jacob Bronowski.
You did do that one. Did you quote him before?
Did you say
I did.
Kyle Broflosky?
And that quote was written in by one of our listeners named Mick.
Thank you, Jay. That was a good quote.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys again. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve.
It was a fun episode this week.
Good times.
Yeah, thanks.
A little unusual with the multiple interviews, but I think it's all worked out. So until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.